Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, again, my name is Craig Johnston. I represent the appellant, Mr. Robert Blurton. I intend to focus my argument primarily today on the first point, which is the failure to give a lesser-included offense instruction, a felony murder. Mr. Blurton was charged with three counts of first-degree murder. He submitted three lesser-included offense instructions for felony murder. Under Section 565.025.2, felony murder is, in fact, a first-level lesser-included offense instruction. Under 556.046, if he makes a timely request for a lesser-included offense instruction, which he did, he's entitled to such an instruction if there is a basis for acquitting him of the greater offense, which there was, and if there was a basis in finding him guilty or convicting him of the lesser offense of felony murder, which he was. In fact, respondent's brief doesn't even challenge that we've met the prerequisites of 556.046. Now, under this case, this court's recent cases in Jackson and Pierce, if in fact the requirements of 556.046 have been met, which they have, and respondent doesn't contest we've met it, there is a presumption of prejudice that results in reversible error.
Now, first off, the state argued that this instruction was not in proper form.
They argued that they didn't. The state argues in its brief that in the first paragraph, it's if you do not find the instructions as submitted said, if you do not find the defendant guilty of murder in first degree, you will consider whether or not he's guilty of murder in the second degree. And the state's position is that it's because there was also a conventional murder instruction given by the state that it should say under this instruction. Now, it is true that if both instructions are given, that it would include that language. But at the time that defense counsel didn't offer both instructions. So at the time defense counsel was preparing their instructions correct. Now, if during the instruction conference, the judge decides, I'm going to give conventional murder for the state, and I'm going to give felony murder for the defense, then both instructions, the state's, which didn't have that language either, and the defense would have to have under this instruction. But that never came up because the court refused to give the felony murder instruction. So I don't believe that should be a bar to relief in this case. Certainly, if the trial court had said, please put this under this instruction language in the felony murder instruction and we'll give it, we would have done so. But it never came up because the court erroneously felt that the felony murder instruction was inconsistent with alibi and was also that it was that the state hadn't charged a felony, but the instructions on felony murder are clear that the state doesn't actually have to charge the felony in order to submit a felony murder instruction. So the court erroneously gave the wrong legal reasons, and so we really didn't get to the form of the instruction. So I do believe that it's preserved for appeal purposes. Even if it wasn't, I would think that when the defense doesn't get the instruction that goes actually to their defense, there would be a manifest injustice, but I don't think we have to go that far.
Well, despite the court not specifically articulating that the improper form was a reason they rejected the proposed instruction, can we review it for being improper?
The court can, but I think under State versus Stepter, this court reviewed it for preserved error when they said, well, that wasn't, you know, the court didn't reject it for that reason.
But I understood you said when you offered it, it was correct. Later on, the court then added another instruction, but that you shouldn't have to go back and revise what
exactly
you'd offered, which is proper when offered.
Exactly.
When it's the state's request that some other instruction was made.
That's right. If defense had offered both instructions, then yes, both of the instructions that we would offer should have that language under this instruction.
Can you tell me again why felony murder, since you have to prove the felony, why is that a lesser included offense in the sense used in Jackson?
Well, why is it a lesser included?
Uh-huh.
It's a lesser included offense just because it's statutorily denominated as a lesser.
Yeah, I understand in that sense,
right.
But Jackson dealt with
nesting.
Because nesting, it's not a right. Nested offense. Can you tell me why the reasoning of Jackson applies to non-nested offenses?
Well, I think parts of the reasoning, certainly Jackson involves a nested as opposed to a denominated
right.
one. And that, I think, goes to whether or not a lesser is actually, you know, what's required mm-hmm. to submit a lesser.
Yes.
And for a nested you only have to disbelieve the state's element in order to get it. So that's where Jackson,
right.
And we're not there. But we are statutorily denominated, so we don't have to deal with that. Where Jackson aids us is the prejudice part, though, in which the Jackson opinion goes to whether or not, you know, if a lesser included is required to be given. In other words, if it fits the requirements under 556.046, then there's a presumption of prejudice. So while Jackson isn't exactly on point because it dealt with a nested instruction and ours deals with a statutorily denominated instruction, I still think that it applies as far as the prejudice and the presumption of prejudice that would exist in the case.
Well, wasn't the Jackson rationale, at least in part, that a nested offense, by definition, if the jury didn't believe that one element of the greater one, but you submitted the greater one, there must be evidence in there to, the jury has a right to decide there's evidence to support the lesser. And that rationale wouldn't apply to a non-nested offense.
Right. So I think, then in a non-nested situation, you actually have to show some affirmative evidence that would support.
But you have that here.
And we have that. The state doesn't actually dispute that there wasn't evidence to support a felony murder. I mean, the victim's wallets were didn't have any cash, even though one victim.
No, I understand that. Thank you.
Was there an aggravator submitted, murder committed in the commission of another felony?
There actually was one aggravator submitted. Yes, to the jury. The state it's pled that as an aggravating circumstance, and it was actually submitted to the jury. Now the jury didn't find that. They didn't find a lot of the aggravators, but the language that's used in that instruction is different because it has a time element involved while that the robbery occurred and the murder occurred while the robbery was going on. So I mean, I don't think that it's that it means anything. The evidence is certainly clear that this was a robbery and that a murder occurred during the course of the robbery, and the state doesn't contest otherwise. Really, what it comes down to is some seemingly contradictory line of cases regarding what the state does to overcome the presumption of prejudice. Now, there have been some cases that said that if murder second is given under the facts of those cases, that the state has overcome the presumption of prejudice. However, this court has also reversed cases. I think I cited in my reply brief the Gardner, the Fear, the Donovan cases, to where murder second involuntary manslaughter instructions were given, but felony murder instructions weren't given, and they did end up at reversal. So I think it's important that you look at the facts of the case. Did the state rebut the presumption of prejudice? And I don't think they did it here, because here the theory of defense, as outlined in the closing argument, was very clear. They may have proven through the DNA and fingerprints that my guy was at the scene, but they didn't prove that he was the shooter. Okay, that was the theory of defense. In other words, felony murder. My guy didn't purposely or deliberately shoot the victim. He was involved in a robbery, and somebody else, and the state didn't prove that it wasn't somebody else, and the somebody else evidence was also through DNA. There was some unknown DNA, male DNA found on two different bindings. Okay. Now, if a jury is faced with that situation, let's say you're in the deliberation room and you've got the state saying this is a deliberate killing and the defense is saying this is felony murder. Any juror tending, and I would note that the jury deliberated for a little over 4 hours, so this wasn't one of these things where the jury didn't totally shut down the defense. Some jurors must have had some concern or listened to the defense in some of the matter. But if you were leaning towards, I really don't think that they've proven that he's the shooter, that juror would be stuck with having to come back with a not guilty verdict because the felony murder. And a juror may not feel comfortable if you believe that this guy's involved in a robbery and basically he set everything into motion and it ended up in these people's
So the
death.
State says that's not true because the jury would have come back with second degree because it was intentional murder, not deliberation. But you're saying that the jury might have thought, well, whoever killed them deliberated.
Exactly.
Because there were three different murders and three different
right.
shots. So second degree is not it, but felony murder might be it if he didn't pull the trigger, but they didn't right. have that option.
Felony murder really is the only other option here. When you have three people lined up, bound and gagged, I mean, the jury's not going to find, well, they purposely killed them, but didn't deliberate.
And it's the state that requested the second degree, traditional second degree.
And I think that shows you how little, how it really didn't match up with the defense at all. I mean, the defendant didn't even request the conventional because that's not their defense. Yes, our guy purposely killed him, but without deliberation, that wasn't their defense. And so the defendant was certainly prejudiced because they, as this court said in Pond, the defendant is entitled to an instruction on any theory of defense. Here we only had one theory of defense and we got no instruction on it. And so it certainly prejudiced the defendant because a juror, if they wanted to vote felony murder, the facts of felony murder, they were forced in a position to where they would have had to come back with an acquittal. And they may have not felt comfortable if they believed my guy was involved in this robbery, set everything into motion to let the guy go off the street. Because they didn't have an adequate instruction to test that.
Could you distinguish again, you did, but I'd just go over it again for me, the difference between the requirement for felony murder and the concurrent felony aggravator?
Well, the way it's worded a little differently. The felony murder instruction is say that the deaths occurred during the perpetration, or as a result of the perpetration of a felony, okay, and certainly that's conceded by the evidence. The aggravator actually says that the murder occurred while, and so it has a time element, and so the jury may have got kind of thought, well, the murder the robbery may have occurred after the murders, or vice versa, and so they didn't find. Actually, almost in all the aggravators, like the burglary, the robbery, the reasons why this murder occurred, and the jury found none of those aggravators. And I think there was probably some question because of the way it's worded.
Did the jury find? Were the aggravators?
The aggravators that the jury found were the multiple homicides.
That was the only one.
Yeah, the multiple homicides because they were bound and rendered helpless.
Depraved and what?
Right. But certainly, regardless of what the jury may have found in the penalty phase later, it's inconclusive that this was a robbery that had occurred. I mean, the rooms were ransacked. I mean, the wallets were out and money was missing and handguns were taking. It would be impossible not to find that the murders were not committed as a result of the perpetration of the robbery. And so I don't think that that's what the jury may have later got confused with or decided in the penalty phase, I don't think matters as far as the giving of the lesser.
You're saying everybody conceded there was a robbery. The question was who did it and who
exactly.
Did it.
Exactly. That was the whole question is, and the defense was stuck with the position to where, there was DNA and fingerprints and cell phone evidence that put my guy at the scene. And so the logical theory of the defense was, my guy may have been there, but if you look at the DNA on the bindings of this victim, the DNA on the bindings of this person, it's an unknown male, and my guy's DNA is not on any of them, not on any of the bindings. And they did some samples of the chest and the bedroom and stuff and found some DNA, and that wasn't my guy's DNA also. So it's a reasonable theory of defense, and the only way to test that theory of defense, though, is through a properly given instruction. And the jury didn't get that instruction. And so I think that the defendant has shown, there's a presumption of prejudice, and I don't think that the state has shown that there's, for overcome the presumption of prejudice, merely because the state, not the defendant, the state gave an instruction that nobody argued, that was nobody's theory of defense, really didn't test the theory of defense because the lesser still required the jury to find that my guy shot the person and it was done purposely. So it didn't test the theory of defense at all. And so I think if you look at some of the the prior Missouri Supreme Court cases in the 1980s, came back reversible error. If you look at the couple of the Western District cases that I cited, the Frost and the Nutt case, they say just because you get another lesser doesn't mean that you're not entitled to a new trial. Because what you have to do is look and see, did the instruction given actually test the theory of defense? Did it adequately test it or not? And here, the conventional murder didn't test it at all. And now I know that there's a line of cases to where they have found otherwise, but I think if you really look at the facts of those cases, like the last one by this court was McLaughlin, but there, the defendant admitted doing the killing. It really was the mental state. You know, what was in his mind at the time of the killing, because it was kind of a boyfriend-girlfriend type thing. And so then conventional murder really was what tested the theory of defense. Now, there was also a rape, although actually the defendant was that the rape occurred after the homicide, so arguably the evidence didn't even support a felony murder, if you believe their thing anyway. But certainly, as far as the murder went, as far as the theory of defense in that case was, it was, did he deliberate or not? And so therefore, conventional murder did adequately test it. Here, it didn't adequately test it. I don't have any other questions. I'll sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Just two preliminary observations before I go into discussing the prejudice aspect of this issue is that, first of all, when the defendant submitted his proposed instruction to the court, he never gave the argument to the court that he intended to submit it on the basis that he was trying to prove that someone else committed the murder. And the instruction that he tendered, in fact, did not hypothesize those set of facts. Actually, as I looked at that instruction again and looked again at the notes on use for preparing an MAI for preparing a felony murder instruction, I saw a further flaw in it in that the instruction that was proposed did not ascribe the shooting to anyone, which is clearly an improper thing. You've either got to ascribe it to the defendant, to an accomplice, whether named or unnamed, or to a third person, such as a victim or a bystander. That wasn't done in this case, and it seems to me that it...
In closing, the only argument was alibi? No other argument?
No, they made the argument, certainly he tried to suggest in the closing argument that this might have been a robbery and someone else did it.
So why wasn't that adequate?
Because the instruction that was submitted would not have guided the jury into making that determination, because the only person that was mentioned in the instruction was the defendant committing the robbery. Silent as to the fact that you've got to say
but,
that
but why did he have to do that? If he's felon, the jury could find it was done during the course of a felony from the evidence, but he's not the one who actually did the murder. Why is it his job to try to prove who else was there, or why couldn't the jury come back with that from the evidence?
Well, again, I'll admit I've never been fully able to grasp the concept of a roving commission, but it seems to me like this would fit the definition of that, because I think it could give you a unanimity problem too, because some jurors could say, well, I think the defendant did commit this shooting during the course of a robbery.
That argument that you're making really go to preservation? In other words, the defendant has to present proper instruction in order for the error to be preserved. His argument covered part of why it wouldn't have had to have a little tail, but it didn't cover the issue that you bring up.
Right. No, I think it does go to preservation, and again, I just.
But if he had submitted it in two different instructions instead of putting all the information in a single instruction, then you would agree there was error? Or what is it you're...
Well, if he submitted a proper instruction that submitted his own act as the shooter in the course of a felony, I would say the evidence would support the giving of that instruction. The idea that someone else may have shot it, I think, is a closer question. I agree there is some unidentified DNA found in one of the bindings. A jury perhaps could infer from that somebody else participated in the robbery. That evidence doesn't make it any more or less likely that the defendant was the shooter as opposed to anyone else. I don't think it does.
Under Jackson, it is a statutory lesser included offense, and there was evidence to support it. Why doesn't under Jackson that make it reversible, presumed prejudice, and you can show why it wasn't prejudicial to fail to give a requested lesser included defense instruction?
And I think the standard is, if we presume a preserved error, that the presumption of prejudice attaches, but that it's overcome by the facts and circumstances of this case, as not only this court, but the U.S. Supreme Court has found in many other instances like this, where the main concern, the concern in Jackson, where no lesser included was given, the concern in many cases where no lesser included is given, is that the jury might convict a defendant of a crime that it doesn't feel he committed but it is not willing to set him free.
The cases do use the language he used, that it tests the theory of the defense. I don't have the magic word that's used, right. But you look at whether the lesser tests the mm-hmm. element that they're claiming was not present, and right. he's explained why he doesn't think conventional murder does. Can you, because it yeah. addresses deliberation versus intent, right. and he wasn't claiming whoever killed him didn't deliberate. He was saying, I didn't do it.
And I would urge the court to go back and look at part three of the Shad opinion from the United States Supreme Court, which addresses a situation very similar to this one. The court first of all found that due process does not require that a defendant be given an instruction on any theory that the evidence might tend to support.
Of course, Jackson says.
Well, again, I think the due process and the prejudice argument kind of flowing, because that was another case where capital murder, conventional murder, second-degree murder were given to a jury. The defendant's theory was, I didn't commit the murder, I just robbed the victim, somebody else shot them, so I want a robbery. And the court said that the fact that the theory, you know, was robbery instead of conventional second-degree does not diminish the reliability of the verdict, because it would be irrational to assume that a jury unconvinced that a defendant committed capital murder, but also given the choice of a lesser degree of murder, would go ahead and find the defendant guilty of that.
But why does that apply here? Why wouldn't a rational jury look at the elements and say, well, no, it was deliberation. So it's just a question of who deliberated and who did the shooting. And so it's not a rational, it is a rational inference if the question is their state of mind.
It's the same thing Shad's saying. We're not convinced you committed this murder, but we're going to go ahead and convict you of the highest degree of murder instead of the lesser. Why would we go to the greater degree?
But because they thought deliberation was proved by whoever did the shooting, and they were going to follow the instructions.
Well,
was there an accessory liability instruction given here?
No, there wasn't. Okay. And the instruction and the notes on use provide for modifying the instruction when there's an accessory liability theory. So there was no accessory liability given in terms of the robbery itself. There was certainly no accessory liability in terms of an accessory committing the murder in this case.
And does he to get a felony murder instruction, is he required under our lesser included under the statute to claim accessory liability? Is there anything that would require him to ask that it be submitted that way?
Well, if he doesn't ask to submit it that way, then he's not giving the jury a basis to find accessory liability. I mean, yes, I think very clearly if your theory is accessory liability, then you've got to submit that in your instruction and give the jury the facts from which it can find that, not just ask the jury to speculate on the basis of, well, I committed the robbery and the guy was shot and, hey, maybe somebody else did it. It's got to be a little more directed than that. So the defendant failed to tender an instruction that would have submitted the theory
so
that he now
in that case, it wouldn't really be a lesser included offense. You're saying if it's an accessory liability, it's not a lesser because you're submitting other facts.
Well, I don't know if we look at the facts strictly to determine whether it's lesser or not, but you're not precluded, I think, from just because the state proceeds on a theory of single liability, you know, precluded from putting an accomplice liability theory in front of the jury if the evidence might
warrant. Well, this is basically the argument you started with, that the instruction he tendered didn't suggest that someone else was the shooter and his liability was for the robbery and for felony murder, if that.
Right. Nor did he even suggest to the court in tendering the instruction that was what he was trying to accomplish. That never even came up.
Did the instruction he submitted, did it comply with MAI?
I don't believe it did for the reasons we set out in the brief in terms of its reference to the other instructions. And as I look at it, I think the instruction, as I read the MAI, you've got to ascribe the shooting to somebody. You know, you look at the language that it gives, you know, the defendant shot some so-and-so. Or the notes on you say if it's an accomplice, you give those, you know, modifications. Or if it's a third party, such as a victim, which can sometimes happen in a felony murder situation, you've got to somehow hypothesize those set of facts.
Is that in the MAI, or is that in the MAI and the notes on you?
And I think it's...
That's what distinguishes this type of lesser from a nested lesser.
Right.
Because it requires additional proof.
Yes,
something other than the jury just not believing something.
Right, and I think even the fact of the underlying felony would, in this situation, certainly be an additional fact that would have to be be proven, because that would not be contained in the first degree murder instructions that were given.
Why isn't this governed by 565.021 that says if you get a second degree instruction, then you have to give the felony instruction if it's supported by the evidence? No language about evidence sufficient to acquit of the greater and convict of the lesser. It says you have to give felony murder if it's supported by the evidence. Why isn't that the governing statute here?
Well, I think if that's the case, though, we still have to look at it from a prejudicial standpoint, and was the presumption of prejudice rebutted in this case by the facts and circumstances, where we can say the jury was given a choice between two different degrees of guilt, and the fact that it found the greater is presumed to mean that the jury found the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the shooter and that he committed the murder after deliberation. And the cases that Mr. Johnson cited in his brief, I would note where reversible error was found, I think were all distinguishable on the fact that those cases dealt with different mental states that were involved and whether the jury was adequately apprised of all the potential mental states. And even the Frost case that he cites in his reply brief distinguished these types of cases when it noted that a determination of premeditation on the part of a jury precludes a conviction on a lesser offense. And that's at page 219 of that opinion, which is 449 Southwest 3rd. So in McLaughlin and in other cases that this court decided, I think the Shad case from the United States Supreme Court is particularly instructive because it deals with a similar scenario. The courts have found that when a jury is given a choice between first-degree murder, a lesser-degree murder, and finds first-degree, we presume that's because the jury found the elements of first-degree were established beyond a reasonable doubt. And
so shall doesn't really mean shall, then, in 565.021.
Well, again, it's a separate question from whether he was entitled to the instruction in the first place to determine the prejudicial effect of not getting that instruction.
But you're saying automatically if you gave, because you only have to give it if you give a conventional second-degree, and they say automatically if you gave conventional second degree, it's not prejudicial, is your argument. So you're saying it's a sort of pointless requirement?
No, the cases I'm talking about, like McLaughlin, were cases where where conventional was given, but felony was not, and the failure to give felony was found not to be prejudicial because the jury returned a verdict on first degree murder.
But that would always be the case, because this statute that you're being asked about says anytime you give conventional, you have to give felony, also if it's requested. And you're saying always if you give conventional, doesn't matter if you fail to give felony.
It kind of makes it
a pointless requirement.
If the jury returns a verdict of first degree. Now, if the jury returned a verdict on conventional second degree, maybe you've got a different. I don't know. I haven't come across those cases or looked at them to see what they say, but that might be a different analysis. But, prejudicial in this sense where the jury returned the first degree.
What about here where there was evidence of some unknown male's DNA in the bindings and not defendant's DNA?
Well, first of all, I don't recall if the DNA was even determined to be male or female.
There was at least one where they determined an unknown male DNA.
I think there was some unknown male DNA where perhaps the defendant was excluded, but the male, but there were a couple of different ones. I know
if there was that evidence,
I think there was one where there was some male DNA and they couldn't tell one way or the other if it was the defendant's or not. There was some DNA where I think the defendant was excluded, but I think that DNA was not determined to be male or female. Just to be clear, that's my recollection
sure.
of it. And I think I can see the jury could make an inference that somebody else might have been present and involved in helping tie the persons up. I could see where a court could find that evidence because there's no direct evidence to establish who fired the shot. I could see where a court would say or could say within its discretion that's sufficient to perhaps warrant the giving of the instruction. I think it's a close enough issue. That's why I determined not to spend a lot of time and energy trying to fight over whether or not they were entitled to the instruction or not, and to instead focus on whether this becomes reversible error under what Jackson stated, which is that error that does not constitute a constitutional violation, and I think Shad makes it pretty clear.
Question was really going to the prejudice of
right.
it, that where there was evidence that would have supported their claim in which they argued that he wasn't the shooter,
mm-hmm.
How can you overcome that?
Well, first of all, the evidence doesn't necessarily establish.
Assuming there was such evidence.
assuming there were more direct evidence of another person being.
No, the evidence here, if it showed another person's DNA in the bindings and failed to show defendant's DNA.
Well, that's a hypothetical. I guess it's a little difficult for me to answer because, again, while there was some evidence that might have suggested someone else's involvement, there certainly that evidence did not in any way exonerate the defendant or not implicate him. And I think it's reasonable that when we know the defendant for certain was there, for certain was taking part because of his voice being on the 911 tape, can we say a jury would have made the leap to say, well, we think somebody else shot him when there's really no evidence that directly suggests that, and at most raises a somewhat tenuous inference that somebody else might have been involved in this case just based on some unidentified DNA on a piece of cloth, and we all know there are any number of ways DNA can get on there. And again, I agree that
but we don't normally reweigh that.
No, we don't reweigh that. We don't know how the jury would weigh that. But I can't say that the evidence suggesting another person shot the victims in this case is so strong that we can somehow use that as the basis of saying that prejudice.
That is directly counter to Jackson, because Jackson says if they don't believe he was the shooter, the state's evidence he was the shooter, for any reason,
sure,
they don't have to have evidence that he wasn't.
Sure.
They can just unbelieve it.
I agree with that, so, but here's what goes, I think, to my point is, no matter how strong the evidence of deliberation, and I think Jackson even used this kind of language, no matter how strong the evidence, the jury can disbelieve that deliberation took place.
But that's not what they were, that's not their defense, so that's not really
relevant. It's not their defense, but nevertheless, in going to why I think the presumption that is normally applied is that by finding first degree, the jury found the state had met its elements beyond a reasonable doubt and was not returning a compromise verdict or a verdict that it felt compelled to because it only had the chance of finding him guilty or setting him free, and where it didn't feel that either one of those alternatives was the appropriate action to take.
But both alternatives required them to find and believe that he was the shooter.
Yes.
So if they disbelieved that, they had no alternative but to convict him of a crime they didn't believe he committed or acquit him.
And why would they convict him of the greater crime when they could have convicted him of the lesser? Why would they sentence him or recommend a death penalty when they could have recommended a life sentence or something less than that if they'd come back with a second-degree murder conviction? Again, as the Supreme Court said in Shedd, we do not presume that level of irrationality from a jury. If a jury is given a choice between a greater offense and a lesser offense and go with the greater, the presumption is that they believe the state proved all the elements of the greater beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that's the reasoning that's been used in Shedd, it's been used in McLaughlin.
Why is that logical in these facts? When everybody agrees that it was deliberation, there was really no basis. Defendant didn't want to submit intentionally, didn't think there was any evidence to support that. He thought there was evidence of a different shooter, and that wasn't tested by the submission.
Well, it wouldn't have been tested by the instruction he wanted to set before the jury, because there was nothing in there to tell the jury that someone else did the shooting. The only person that they talk about, the defendant committed the robbery. The defendant's the only person discussed in that. If you're a jury and reading that, would you read that to say, well, this must mean somebody else shot him? No, I think what the instruction would say was that the defendant shot the victims during the course of committing a robbery, which again puts you down into the lower mental state, and just because the felony, the commission of the felony, is another means of proving the mental state. If he wanted to put that theory before there, he should have drafted an instruction that specifically said another person, defendant and another person committed this robbery, and during the course of the robbery, the other person shot the victims. It's the counsel's responsibility under 28.02 to present properly drafted instructions in the first place. It's not the court's job to modify them or to correct them, especially in the midst of a trial. So, again, there is no prejudice from rejecting this particular instruction, because it wouldn't have done what the defendant wanted it to do. And even if it could be read as doing that, again, the rule that has been laid down time and again, the presumptions that have been used by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court, is that we don't presume a jury is so irrational when given a choice as to go with the greater offense unless it believes that the state proved the elements of all that offense beyond a reasonable doubt. And unless there are any other questions, we ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Johnston, how did the felony murder instruction that was offered comply with the notes on use in paragraph second?
In paragraph second about was shot and killed?
It simply says the victim was shot and killed, and the notes on use say that suggests using the same causation description as in other instructions, and they give the examples. Defendant caused the death by shooting him, or and the name of an accomplice caused the death of the victim by shooting.
Right, but this is the first time they brought this up, so I haven't looked at the notes on use, but I would say this, for it couldn't track the earlier instructions because the other instructions were that the defendant purposely shot. And so it couldn't track any of the other earlier instructions. The other thing is the defendant didn't know who did the shooting, so they didn't put it. The other thing is, I would say under Stepter says, you know, when it's clear that the judge doesn't reject, you know, if the state, I guess, now is saying it should have said, second, that Donnie Luchin, or the victim, was shot and killed by an unknown person. Well, they didn't make that complaint, and the judge didn't reject it on that, and it could have easily been added. And under Stepter, who
knows what the theory of the case is at that point in time better than the defense lawyer? I understand all the evidence right. is in, but nobody but the defense lawyer knows how he's going to argue the case.
Well, I agree, and I think it's implied, though, because the first paragraph is all the defendant did this, the defendant did. In other words, the defendant by himself did the robbery is the first paragraph. Okay, he didn't need to do accomplice liability because they were going to admit, under their instruction, you've got enough to prove that my guy committed a robbery by himself. Okay, and then it says Donnie Luchin was shot and killed, which is in direct contrast to the earlier instructions, which said that the defendant's the one who did the shooting, and this clearly is not alleging that the defendant did the shooting. And I think it's implicit in that we're not saying that the defendant, we're saying somebody else did the shooting because we're not saying that was shot and killed by the defendant. Like the other two instructions.
I thought you were saying the implication was because of the way the first paragraph's drafted that it meant he was the shooter.
No. I mean, if he was the shooter, then we'd be back then.
Because, you know, this idea there was another shooter is your strongest argument
right.
for reversal, and yet it's not reflected in the charges, in any of the state's charges. There's no talk about accessory liability. It's not reflected in the proffered felony murder instruction.
But
and I think it's a minor aspect of the closing argument at best. If it's mentioned there, it's the closing argument didn't center on the fact that this guy may have been guilty of the robbery, but his accomplice was guilty of premeditated or intentional murder.
I guess I reread the closing argument, and I think that was the whole theory of the thing, because the defense attorney kept going back to say, but, you know, they have this evidence, but that doesn't mean that he was the shooter. And he kept going back, but that doesn't mean that he was the shooter. It didn't say that he wasn't there. He was focusing on the fact he wasn't the shooter. And this instruction would, in fact, the first paragraph which submits the robbery, you don't have to put accomplice liability in that part because the defendant was part of the robbery. And so even though you may have been helped by somebody else doing a robbery, if you also commit the elements by yourself, you don't have to ascribe the elements to an accomplice. You don't have to submit that for it.
If the theory of the defense really was that somebody else was the shooter, why wouldn't that have been the focal point of the felony murder instruction?
Well, the second paragraph just says it was shot and killed, and what they're saying is it was shot and killed by some unknown, basically implicit in that, by somebody we don't know. And certainly we would have fixed the instruction if that, or put that. That would have been their major complaint at trial was, Well, it says was shot and killed, but you need to put by at least an unknown assailant or by somebody else, then we would have done that. But under Scepter was a situation where they actually put the wrong mental state in. They ascribed purposely when that was actually an option. And the Scepter clearly said that wasn't why the instruction was rejected. The instruction was rejected for the wrong substantive reason.
And it was rejected here because they thought it was not a lesser or a potential?
Well, they were rejected here because robbery wasn't charged and because the defense submitted alibi. And so, well, that's inconsistent with alibi. But if you really, you know, and the case law is clear that those are improper reasons. Now, the Attorney General's office responded also mentions about the Shad case, but the Shad case really doesn't control here because that, as pointed out in Jackson, there's a separate Missouri statutory requirement of lesser included. Shad only deals with, was they had a specific narrow question, does the Beck versus Alabama require, does the constitutional aspects of Beck versus Alabama constitutionally require lesser included as to all offenses? But as Jackson points out, Missouri, in fact, there Jackson specifically said we don't even have to deal with the Constitution because we have a statute. And so Shad doesn't preclude the analysis. Shad is whether or not it was constitutionally required to give a lesser, but we have a statutory requirement, both under 556.046, 565.021, I think, and the one that's mentioned, also the one where in the subsection 3 on the second degree, it specifically says if the evidence supports conventional and felony murder, you get both of them. And so.
Does the fact that your proposed instruction doesn't ascribe the shooting to somebody else factor into the prejudice analysis?
I don't think it does. I think it's implicit.
What would the defense counsel have been allowed to argue that he wasn't allowed to argue?
Well, it wouldn't have changed his argument, but it would have changed what the jury could have found. Ultimately, the jury was not given an instruction to where they could sign a verdict that was consistent with the theory of defense, that my guy was involved in a felony murder, but he wasn't the shooter. And if you look at the instructions, the murder first didn't cover that. Murder second was that alleged that he purposely shot them. And that would only leave the jury with an acquittal. So if they believe my guy was guilty of a felony murder, under the instructions they had, their only option would be to let him walk out of the street. And that's the whole purpose, the whole reason behind wanting to give lessers. The jury may feel uncomfortable under his admitted parts of it, as supported by the closing argument, in letting him walk out on the street. And they were never tested that. As State versus Ponce, you're entitled to an instruction on any theory. And here, he only had one theory, and he got no instruction on it. And so he was prejudiced by it. If I don't have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.